All I would say is, for as long as we retain the magnificent sense of fatalism for which this country is renowned, I don't think we're in any immediate problems.
Best one on Twitter was C3PO, and he said, "We're doomed."
Well, the other one was the reason. Put someone going. The reason for the strength of the Sunderland vote was because they thought they were voting to leave Sunderland.
Hello and welcome to the Forums podcast on Monday the 27th of June, and on this edition, our assistant editor, Steve Withers.
You green-blooded hobgoblin.
Ed Selly.
Do they still have sandwiches there?
And news editor Mark Hodgkinson.
Permission to speak freely, sir.
Permission denied. Welcome to this week's AV Forums podcast, taking place, the recording, on Friday morning, where the biggest bombshell in this country's history has just been dropped, basically. So we're not going to even cover it today, because I think emotions are still a little bit high. Reading Facebook, it's almost like the whole world's going to kick off. The end has come and all the rest of it, which is a load of nonsense. We all know it's a load of nonsense. And come Monday morning when you're listening to this podcast, it'll all be forgotten about anyway, and everybody will be back to their normal ways of life. So anyway, moving on. Current competitions. What do we have, Mr. Hodge?
We have got the copy of The Mist on Blu-ray, which is by Stephen King, well, the book was, and that's open to active members till the 28th of June. We've still got the Noon VR headset up for grabs, which is open to all members, and that closes on the 30th of June. And then probably the star prize or prizes are 5 pairs of Q Acoustics BT3 Bluetooth speakers, and that's available to all members until the 13th of July.
So some cracking stuff to win there in the competitions. So get yourself entering there if you're an active member or an all member. Get yourself entering, some good stuff there, especially the speakers, 5 pairs of them as well to give away. 2016 strikes yet again when it comes to celebrity deaths, and I don't think anybody had this person down at all. Although he has hit the age of 27, which seems to be a pretty fatal age in Hollywood. A lot of people die at the age of 27 if they're a Hollywood celebrity. Who are we talking about, Steve?
We're talking about Anton Yelchin, who probably is best known for playing Chekhov on the Star Trek reboot. So he's Star Trek, Star Trek Into Darkness, and Star Trek Beyond, which is coming out, I think, next month. So really sad news. 27 years old, incredibly young, and also died rather bizarrely in a really tragic accident. His four-wheel drive car was on his driveway, which was on a slope, and he got out of it to go and do something at his gate, and it rolled down the hill and trapped him and crushed him against a security post. So very tragic, very sad. I mean, it would be almost comic if it was under such different circumstances, but this was very sad. And I thought he was a good actor. He's probably also quite well known for playing Kyle Reese in the he was one of the better things, actually, in Terminator Salvation. I thought he actually did a pretty good version of a younger Michael Biehn, playing Kyle Reese in that film. And most recently was seen in a film called Green Room, which got very good reviews on this site. And is a film I'm actually quite looking forward to seeing. So I very bittersweet, because it's going to make watching, I mean, ironically, the week he died, Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness had just come out on Ultra HD Blu-ray. And obviously we've got Star Trek Beyond coming out in a few weeks. So it's going to be a bit bittersweet watching that film, knowing that it was the last thing he did. So very sad, very sad.
But there is this thing about the age of 27, isn't there?
Yeah, it is. It is. I think, was River Phoenix 27 when he died?
Yep.
Was that? Yeah. Late 20s is always a bit tricky, I think. It seems to be late 20s and late 60s are definitely bad times. Quite a lot of film stars and pop stars as well.
Yeah, it's more musicians, isn't it?
Pop their clogs in the late 20s.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was that 29 was also a bad year. I know quite a few people pop their clogs at 29, but let's be honest, 27, 29, it's too young.
It's not going to make any
far
difference.
Too young.
Not going to make any difference to anybody on this podcast, though. We're well past that.
Yes.
We're far closer to the 50 mark.
Very close to the 50 mark now.
Anyway, so sad news, yeah. Moving on, let's go to hardware news. And Epson are launching a new range of projectors, which are going to be Ultra HD and support HDR. Very much the same kind of tech that JVC have. Yet it looks like they're going to come in at extremely competitive prices, Mark.
Yeah, very much so. There's two they've announced with the HDR and UHD compatibility, although we should stress that not UHD panels. We've got the Procinema 6040UB and the 4040, which both go on sale in the US this August. The flagship Procinema is priced at just under $4,000, while the 4040 is $2,700, more or less.
So we were saying competitive, but if that's in dollars, then you can almost triple that on today's news.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah, the news has changed somewhat in the last few days, I guess. Yeah, so that'll work out at roughly £25,000 for the flagship. And I don't know. It's all speculation for now. A lot will change by August.
It's a strange time of the year to be announcing projector launches as well, because you're in the height of summer. Well, fair enough, not in this country. We're talking about the US release here. In the height of summer, who wants to be sitting in a dark room watching or even reviewing projectors? Speaking of someone who has been doing that this week and has
quite a bit recently,
and has a Sony turning up today as well, so that's more sitting in a dark room this week. But yeah, it seems a strange time of year to announce new projectors.
It's not even tying in with any particular big shows. Is I always thought they announced these kind of things around Cydia.
Yeah, well, it kind of makes sense because that's September, so you're getting into the Dark Knights are starting to roll in again, yeah. and you're starting to get excited again because it gives you an excuse to go and watch films in a dark room.
It was nothing to do with the Euros because obviously this is an American audience. So.
Yep. Yeah. So there's no UK announcement yet on these machines, so we don't even know if they're coming to the UK, and if they are, they'll certainly be different model numbers because that's always the way with Epson, and the US models never have the same names as the UK models, so perhaps we'll get something at IFA.
No. The new projectors, these are all bulb-based, aren't they? None of them are laser projectors, LS10000. I mean, it'd be interesting to see. Did the announcement about updating that to support HDR?
No, snang in the release about it.
Because obviously, I think from a point of view of things like HDR and wider colour spaces, laser is definitely the best way to deliver that. So it'll be interesting to see what they do in terms of future laser projection models. And not just from Epson, obviously. I think all the manufacturers must be looking at that now as a possibility going forward, hopefully at a competitive price, because obviously Sony have got one already, but that's, what, 50, 60 grand? So it's a bit toppy price-wise. But the LS10000 was $5,999 in this country, so that's laser projection at a more affordable price. So
I think the thing for most people, certainly reading the thread on the forums as well, is that if this comes in at £2,000-3,000 for these models, they're going to get snapped up because they can accept UHD signals, and HDR is not a big thing at the minute in terms of projectors. There's no standard there whatsoever, so until there's some way of moving HDR into projectors, I think the big story is the price point. It's got the same pixel tech that JVC use, to get the higher resolution from the two 1080 panels, so it's using the same technology as that. So that, I think that's the big story on that, and certainly we need a bit more competition in the market. And I think this Fox 4K stuff, this is where I think the projector market's going to be for the next year or two. I don't think you're going to see many native 4K projectors come in, and even the Texas Instruments DLP thing's not native 4K anyway.
No, it's not, actually, although they've been quite disingenuous in their promotion of that particular projector by giving the impression it is, but technically it isn't. I think, yeah, you're right, Phil. I think that there will be, I mean, up to now, there's only been 4K, native 4K projectors from Sony. Hopefully, we will see at least some other manufacturers start to do native 4K projectors. Although, in the case of DLP manufacturers, obviously, they're very much dependent on what Texas Instruments can do. But that, I suspect, won't be at a particularly, that'll be a fairly high-priced projector, even if it is from an alternative manufacturer. So you're right. For the affordable price range, for that sort of less than $5,000 bracket, and down, we're going to be looking at these sort of faux 4K approaches that we've seen so far from JVC and from Epson, which I have to say, in my personal experience, do work extremely well.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, I had the VW520 and the X7000 side by side, and of course the native looks slightly sharper, a little bit more detail there, but when you got them side by side, and from a reasonable viewing distance, I say about 7 feet from, say, 100 inches diagonal, you'd be hard pressed. And there's the major difference in image quality is other attributes. like black levels, like shadow detail, like color response compared to resolution.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, just because it isn't native 4K, definitely don't write it off. Because, as I said, as you just said, this technology does actually work very well. It's very effective, and you will still get a high resolution experience from Ultra HD 4K Blu-rays and any other Ultra HD source that you've got. But also you'll get other benefits as well. So it's definitely something that's... and if Epson can deliver that kind of thing and much lower price point, because even the X5000 is what, that's just over $3,000. So if they can get down to a lower price point, a more mass market price point, then I think that's good news for the projector market all around, really.
Yeah, it is. And we can all get ready to sit in dark rooms come the winter. Why is it there's never any projectors launched in the winter when you are sitting in a dark room watching food? It's always during the summer and I have to suffer for my art. Basically,
well, it's like I only ever get sent products with valves in when it's this time of the year and it's bastard hot. Those are the rules. I never ever get sent a valve amplifier in the dead of winter when it would be a lovely, lovely thing to just have purring away and acting as a storage heater at the same time. It's just the rules.
Yeah. Okay, talking about old-fashioned technology and Ed, turntables. There's a new one and you've reviewed it.
Yes, Ellipson. Who we have looked at some Ellipson items before. They're most famous for their spherical speakers, which they've been producing in various forms for about 40 years now. But they've taken it upon themselves to launch a turntable. And as I've tried to explain in the review, there's a difference between some companies launching turntables and it's either a rebadged product from another manufacturer or it heavily relies upon components that already exist out in the market that have been assembled and put together to make a turntable. This is completely bespoke. Other than having an Autophon cartridge on it, because making cartridges is quite hardcore, it doesn't have anything in common with anybody else's equipment. And this is both an extreme sort of statement of confidence in terms of where Ellipson sees the market and how much further potential the market's got in it. But it's also makes for a very interesting comparison to the established order. Obviously, if you want the full rundown, please just go and read the review. It's still likely to be well and truly on the front page on the Monday when this goes out. But by and large, this is a very, very good record player. And it also feels extremely, so it's an extremely high quality item to sort of use and interact with, and it's, yeah, it demonstrates that, you know, there is a fair amount of confidence in analog at the moment, and it's always nice to see that, not only at the high end where, you know, the margins are such that there's not that much risk involved, but also here at the affordable end as well.
Steve, are you still tempted to get a turntable on your system?
I have certainly been toying with the idea, yeah. I think partly just out of nostalgia, I think mainly. But some of them do look really nice. And I think if I don't, it's purely because I've found alternative things to spend the money on. there is definitely, I feel this pull towards vinyl in a way that I haven't in since the mid-80s, basically. And having read quite well, I've read all of Ed's reviews of turntables he's been doing over the last year or so. I think partly it's the way that Ed it fills with so much enthusiasm that you think like, oh yeah, I quite fancy getting a turntable and some records. But it's just a question of you know, how much use will I actually get out of it, or would I be buying it purely to sort of sit there and look at? And I think it would probably fall into the latter category more, because even these days, sitting down to listen to music is something that I don't get around to doing very often, other than as part of a testing process.
Well, look at it this way. We are, as of this morning, heading back to the 1970s. So I would suggest, yeah, the record player is the must-have accessory of the moment. So yeah, go for it. Analog rules okay.
You heard it here first on the Cutting Edge EV Forums podcast. talking about Cutting Edge, let's go to our first OLED TV review of 2016, Steve.
Yeah, finally, after much waiting, the LG 55-inch C6 has turned up for review. So just for those who probably don't know, there are four different categories of OLED TV this year from LG. There's the B6, the C6, the E6, and the G6. The B6 and C6 are kind of the entry-level cheaper version, but I use the term cheap, you know, very loosely. They're still 55-inch models are still £2,999, so that's fairly expensive for a TV. You can get an awful lot of telly for that kind of money. And then the E6 and the G6 are kind of the more flagship models with them. The difference in terms of the actual technology involved, in terms of the panels, they are identical. So really what you're getting when you go for the higher end models is more of more about the design, the build quality, and having built-in soundbars, this kind of stuff. Whereas the C6 and B6 are pretty basic in terms of their construction. They're a bit plasticky. Certainly the C6 that I've got, it definitely, compared to the E6, which I have seen quite a bit recently, I mean, that is a gorgeous piece of kit. Absolutely beautiful industrial design, no question about it. It really is stunning, and it looks the part. Whereas the C6 looks, compared to that, a little bit plasticky, but still incredibly thin. It uses a curved panel. The big difference between the B6 and the C6 is the C6 is curved, and the C6 also has passive 3D, which the B6 does not. So if you're looking for an OLED television with passive 3D, and you don't want to pay up for the E6 or G6, then really the C6 is your only option, unfortunately, at the moment. The B6 does not support 3D. So design-wise, though, I still think it's a very attractive TV. It isn't as attractive as the more expensive models, but I still think it looks very nice. Ultra slim, obviously, but obviously deeper further down where the speakers and electronics are housed. It doesn't have the same remote control as the more expensive models. It's got a magic remote, but it's the basic model that we saw last year, whereas the new the more expensive models have quite flashy remotes that look really nice. But otherwise, in terms of the architecture, and you know, in terms of the system architecture, it's basically the same. So we've got WebOS, of course, and we have OLED. And this year, they ship supporting HDR and Dolby Vision, as we've discussed quite at length already. And in terms of performance, I have to say that, you know, with standard dynamic range content, the I think the OLED looks stunning. I mean, we've all seen OLEDs. We've reviewed them over the last couple of years, and the performance has been excellent. There have been some issues in the past, and I think LG have come a long way in terms of addressing many of those issues. Certainly, I can safely say that the issues with vignetting, with dark edges, that is gone. I mean, that's not on this TV at all. That's not an issue. There is still a bit of an issue just above black. There is still some of that banding in there that people have talked about in the past, and I can see that what LG are doing in order to improve the shadow detail just above black, which has not been a strong point with OLED. There was a definite dip at 5 IRE in terms of, you know, just lightening the pitch up a little bit so you get a bit more shadow detail. If you remove that dip using the calibration controls, you basically crush out a lot of shadow detail. So that's still an issue as far as OLED is concerned. But in terms of picture quality, absolutely stunning. And got those deep blacks, which give a very solid foundation to the image. Color accuracy is excellent, absolutely excellent on this TV, as was the out of the box performance. So with Rec 709 and D65, so fantastic there. It tracked gammas of 2.2 or 2.4 very accurately. So again, that's really good. So I couldn't really fault it in terms of its performance with standard dynamic range content. Looks superb. Where I think it doesn't, they've obviously introduced two different standards as far as Ultra HD Premium is concerned, one for LCD, LED technology, and one for OLED, because clearly whilst it has the really deep blacks and then the absolutely deep blacks, it struggles when it comes to peak brightness. Now, it has certain advantages over LCD, because LCD, even ones with local array backlights, full array local dimming backlights, and even, say, the DX902, which has got 512 local dimming zones, obviously with OLED, it's a pixel-based, you know, it's technology based upon self-emitting pixels, so it has a pixel-level control in terms of specular highlights for things like HDR. That is good. It can go right down to the pixel level, so there's a lot more precision and control in terms of that. But it does, you know, in terms of its actual brightness, clearly it's, you know, it's an OLED, and that it's even when you're driving it as much as you can. I measured it on a 10% window at over 550 nits, which was within the specs for Ultra HD Premium certification for OLED. But compared to the 1,000 nits that the content is actually being mastered at, that is a big difference. And I definitely felt that in comparison with a 1,000 nit LCD TV like the 9500, just Samsung 900 that I reviewed just before, which I had at the same time, they overlapped, HDR content had more impact. Even though the blacks were obviously were blacker on the OLED, and there was a bit more precision in terms of delivering it, it just felt like it didn't quite have the same impact that some of the better LCD televisions have had so far this year.
That's interesting.
And So it still looked great. Don't get me wrong. I'm not knocking that aspect of it. It looked great, but it just didn't feel like you were getting that kind of real dynamic punch sometimes in the brighter things. In the dark parts, definitely, but not in the brighter parts. Now, what was interesting is I had some clips encoded in Dolby Vision that were provided by Dolby, and they were clips of Pan. Now, they'd provided us with a copy of Pan on Blu-ray as well as these clips. Now, that didn't seem like a very fair comparison to me because, you know, Pan is available on Ultra HD Blu-ray in HDR10, so I thought that's a more direct comparison, so that's what I actually compared. And it was interesting that the C6 was clipping certain scenes on the HDR10 Ultra HD Blu-ray that it wasn't doing in Dolby Vision. And those scenes weren't being clipped on other TVs like the 9500. But there was a particular scene where there was this ship heading towards Neverland, and there was a sun setting over Neverland, and the sun was clearly defined in both Dolby Vision and on HDR10 on the Samsung, but not defined that well on the C6. So it definitely was clipping HDR10 content. Now, whether that's a limitation of OLED, and that's quite possible. And maybe that's one of the reasons why they've got into bed with Dolby Vision, because it gives them more control in terms of dynamic metadata to deliver a better performance.
I was just going to say, Steve, it sounds like a software issue, because they're both based on the same, what we'd call traditionally call a gamma curve. So they're both based on the same PQ standard. So if one's clipping and the other one isn't, that has to be a software issue, because they should basically both be tracking the same.
Yes, they should be. They should be, but weren't, which is interesting because, we've heard other manufacturers go on about, you know, limitations of OLED when it comes to HDR, but you'd think, well, they are going to say that because obviously they've got, you know, they've got their own TVs to sell and they want to try and diss OLED wherever they can. But in my experience, I did sort of feel that I felt like it just wasn't quite the same experience that I'd been getting before. And I guess, you know, when you think about it, that range, yeah, you are. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, we know that when we're looking at an HDR image, a lot of the time it's not going to be, you know, it's not 1,000 nits. Obviously, it's only going to be every now and then in small little highlights. But it was a lovely picture. Don't get me wrong, absolutely stunning picture. But at times, I just felt like I wasn't quite getting the same kind of impact on something like, say, the Revenant that I did on other TVs, which is an interesting. I wasn't quite expecting that conclusion. There you go.
But then that points to how the human eye works and how the brain's tricked with brighter objects, Steve. So, you know, if the Samsung 9500 is going brighter, even in those smaller areas for the specular highlights, and even only now and again, if it is brighter, then naturally your brain's going to think it's right.
Mm. True. I mean, I guess, you know, if you're thinking, if it's being encoded up to 1,000, it's an ideal, I think you do want a television that can deliver up to 1,000 nits. Clearly, OLED can't. That isn't its strong point. I think it's impressive that LG have brought the technology on as fast as they have, given, you know, things have moved pretty fast in the last year or two in terms of things like HDR, and they've tried to keep OLED still relevant. And they've done a pretty good job in terms of that. They've also done a very good job in terms of addressing certain issues that have been picked up in the past. You know, and I think they've got to commend LG in terms of the work they've done in both developing and driving OLED as a technology, because they are pretty much the only ones doing it at the moment. And what they are delivering is in many respects absolutely superb. You could say, you know, you are paying a bit of a premium for this performance, but certainly if you're looking for a really, really high quality image, particularly with standard dynamic range content, which, let's be honest, is going to be most of what we're going to be watching for the foreseeable future, then there's no question that this TV delivers. And, you know, the whole package itself, I think, works well too, because I really do like things like WebOS. I think it's a great platform. And, you know, and I do like even the cheaper, I thought even the cheaper design, you know, though it's not as attractive and as flashy and as well-made as the higher-end models, I still think that it looks nice, you know. And I'm glad you got the choice of flat or curved, although I wish there was also the option for passive 3D on the B6. Although it will be interesting when we do get a B6 in for review to see if the lack of a polarized filter makes any difference compared to the other models. But overall, it's a superb performing TV. I think LG have done a fantastic job. The big question mark now over OLED generally is when these panels are being driven quite hard with things like HDR, is just what will that impact that will have on their lifespan. And also, I should point out that definitely when using test patterns with HDR content particularly, but even with non-HDR content, there was some image retention. So that is still an issue as far as OLED is concerned. Although LG have gone to quite big lengths to ensure that that things like image retention is minimized and there's no screen burn. So things like it'll wash itself when it's in standby mode, that kind of stuff. So there are safety features in place, but it will be interesting to see just what impact on the lifespan of OLED driving the panel, you know, as hard as HDR might have to at times, will have on it.
Mark, I guess on Steve's evidence there, it kind of points towards where Samsung are taking their next generation TVs and why they're not going OLED, because what you're talking about is not only huge investment in trying to get OLED up to standard, because they ain't going to buy any panels from LG Display. I think that's positively clear.
So
Samsung would really have to start development. If they are developing behind the scenes, it's going to cost them more, because what they have to do now is up the brightness to try and get to 1,000 nits. A thousand nits. They're going to have to put even more investment in that. So you can see why publicly they're sticking with, quantum dot and moving LED LCD on, because that's going to be a huge hell of a cost to development, a screen that's going to get anywhere close to what the LED LCDs can do at the minute.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see. Obviously, they were going down a different path with their OLED development in terms of the way they structure their panels. And obviously they decided it's too expensive and they're chasing the big numbers with brightness now. And if there's no prospect of them bringing them up to the standard of their current LED LCDs, then you'd think why would they bother, especially if they're still selling like hotcakes. I believe they're doing quite well in the UHD TV market, certainly in the States. I've not got any UK figures, but I believe they're fairly dominant in that market too. So, why chase that when they're being successful doing what they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the US, it is LG and Samsung. I mean, that was pretty obvious. And the two major retail chains that we looked at when we were over for CES, went to Fry's and went to Best Buy, and there were big out of town retail premises as well. And you couldn't find a Panasonic anywhere. And there was only five or six Sony TVs. And everything else was LG and Samsung.
I do wonder whether one of the Chinese manufacturers might come in, the likes of Hisense, come in with an OLED and try and undercut LG and really push it big. I sense that's probably more of a realistic thing to happen in the next couple of years, and Samsung entering the OLED market anyway.
Yeah, you're probably right on that one. And I guess, looking at this, Steve, OLED, it really is LG's baby, and if it's going to succeed, it looks like LG is going to have to put the funding in to make that so, because they might sell the odd panel to a third party here and there, but at the end of the day, they're going to have to make it work.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they've already invested billions. It's been a fairly sizable gamble on their part, I think, to really put the weight of their company and their entire TV division behind a single technology. I think they've delivered, definitely delivered in terms of not just OLED as a technology, but also taking it, adding in things like starting off with full HD. They've gone from that to Ultra HD, and now that they're supporting HDR, wider color gamut. So the color gamut's almost 100%, it's 96% of DCI P3. It's unfortunately, interestingly, measuring the tracking against Rec 2020, the LG tracks in almost exactly the same as the Samsung's. They track against DCI P3, whereas the Japanese manufacturers that I've tested so far, I mean Sony, Panasonic, and even JVC, their Rec 2020 modes have actually tracked to Rec 2020. So there seems to be a Korean-Japanese disparity going on at the moment in terms of how they track
Steve, this is an update since the software update with the Samsungs. I've got a KS9000 here at the second. The auto color space tracks differently now.
Oh, is it? Oh, excellent.
Not well. it's all over the place. So it's quite a bit wider than Rec 709, but it is absolutely all over the place. It definitely needs to be native for HDR content to make it look, you know, reasonable. And in native, it's tracking very much like DCI-P3, so nothing's changed there. But in terms of the auto, something has changed, but not necessarily for the better. It's wider, but absolutely.
Because the auto wasn't actually, it was meant to, if it detects Ultra HD, it was meant to switch to the wider color space, but it was just always at Rec 709, no matter what I sent it. So that's obviously, at least that's been addressed to a degree, if not totally successfully.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it was totally successful.
But yeah, going back to your original point, Phil, I think LG have taken great strides with OLED. They've clearly put an awful lot of their corporate goodwill and their own money into the technology, and so far it looks like it's paying off, because the TVs are selling well. They are the dominant player, obviously. They provide panels for other manufacturers. The question, the interesting thing is going to be what happens going forward. We all know that OLED is superior to LCD in terms of, you know, it's wider color, wider viewing angles, much better black levels. Obviously, you've got the precision of each individual pixel being illuminated. So from that aspect, there's no question it's a superior technology. Where it struggles, obviously, is in terms of its peak brightness and overall brightness as well, because it's, you know, it's not as bright. That's just the nature of the technology. And the fact that they can get it as high as they have got it in such a short period of time is impressive. But if we're moving towards a world where we're going to have, you know, when we've got 1,000 nit content, but, you know, they are being mastered at 4,000 nit, and that is the general direction we seem to be going in. And we will see LCD panels that can do 4,000 nits being announced at least this year, if not at least one, I think, in September it's going to be announced. So from Sony, that's what we've heard. So there's going to be at least one TV that can do 4,000 nits. I mean, that's the direction we're going in. And I doubt that OLED is ever going to be able to achieve this kind of brightness level. So that does leave, it's a tricky position that they could find themselves in where, whilst they've developed a great technology, things move on in another direction that wasn't initially the case when they first started developing this, 5 years ago, or much longer than that ago. But when did we go to Monte Carlo? 2012.
2012.
So 4 years ago, they were launching OLED, and it was like, it was fantastic. You know, that could be lived in a Rec 709 D65 world with 100 nits peak brightness. So suddenly we've gone to a completely different world, and that is where we're going. And it might take time for us to transition into that world, but that's the direction we're going in now.
So you're talking about OLED or the EU? Life without the EU.
Well, yeah. What's going to be interesting is what happens with things like, Sony's already been talking about, you know, not necessarily for domestic use, but they've shown it before, and they've been talking about it again, using what they refer to as crystal LED, but basically using individual LEDs for the red, green, and blue subpixels in the pixels. And Samsung have also been talking about something similar. If they can deliver that technology at a realistic price point, suddenly you've got a game changer, haven't you? Because then you've got absolute blacks, but you've got 4,000 nits, possibly. And suddenly, you know, that's a whole different ballgame, isn't it? And it's possible maybe that is what people like, you know, manufacturers like Samsung and Sony have been thinking about, and why they've stopped really pushing.
Yeah, again,
they realize maybe deliver something else entirely different by taking a completely different approach, as long as obviously it's a realistic price point.
Yeah, but Steve, what we're talking about here, though, is when we saw CLED on a 55-inch screen, it was 1080.
Mm.
You're now talking about UHD, and if you're talking about 3 pixels... You're talking about ultra nano technology there, really. Yeah.
But I'm just saying, if they can achieve that in a realistic screen size, that's a big, at a realistic price point, would be a massive game changer. And that's probably the only risk, I think, right now. I think at the moment, LG's bet's paying off. But something like that could really scupper them if someone did manage to achieve that.
Assuming they're not doing it themselves.
Well... It wouldn't surprise me, given how much Samsung and LG's tech.
Well, I guess the other way you have to look at it is how many people are actually still making panels and still producing them, and would have the likelihood of having production lines in place to take on a new technology like that. Because Sony couldn't build that themselves. Because Sony don't do their own panels anymore.
LG Display is still the biggest panel manufacturers in the world, aren't
they? Yeah. So, you know, Sony might have this technology, but they're going to have to go to a third party to develop it and to make the panels. Mm. So you're talking about a hell of a investment in that kind of thing. And I think you're talking a good 10 years away anyway before you get to that technology. Because, again, you're talking 4K resolution, 3 pixels per pixel space. That's nanotechnology on a on an unheard of scale at the minute. Not doable, I would suggest, Mark.
What's that, 24 million-ish? That's a lot. That's tiny.
Teeny tiny LEDs.
Yeah, the manufacturers would have, you would think they would have a problem with that. I'm not an expert on manufacturing, of course, so I don't know. But yeah, it sounds like a tall order for sure. And particularly since, you know, they said at the time of the CLED at CES, you know, this is concept technology as it was, and then everything's literally changed within a couple of years.
Yeah, so. And their announcement recently, that was for a mega-sized screen where they could get away with normal-sized LEDs as well.
Yeah, and it was made up of various smaller panels that all slotted together, so it wasn't a one like one panel, as it were. It was made up of very small sort of 32-inch size TV panels stuck together. So yeah, I think we're some way off that.
Yeah, although it's interesting, and it's interesting to see, you know, how LED, LCD and OLED compete in the marketplace going forward. I guess HDR is a game changer. And it'll be interesting to see come IFA. I'm expecting 2 or 3 interesting announcements there.
Philips OLED will come, but is that going to be IFA?
I think that's a given, and I think strong money would be on, although we haven't had any inside information whatsoever or anything to suggest it, I would also strongly suggest that some money's put in Panasonic doing a similar 55-inch flat OLED. I think if Philips are doing it, I don't see why Panasonic wouldn't do that.
And we'll also see Sony's version of production version of the TV that we saw being shown at IFA, filled with the 4,000 nits.
4,000 nits. I've got to say that was impressive, but then, you know, how's it going to look with other material? And once you got off axis, it did start to bloom, and there was quite a bit of halo in there as well. So, be interesting to see if they've managed to do anything with that going forward. But standing dead on with 4,000 nits and that Vegas skyline and the cars and everything else and the specular highlight, it looked really, really impressive.
It did.
And that was in a dim area of the stand as well, so it wasn't under full lighting either. It was really quite outstanding. So anyway, we need to move on because we're running rapidly out of time, so that's hardware news. We'll be back with, have we got a review?
Yes, I saw it last night.
So we'll be movie reviews next. So, Steve, what's at the cinema? And please tell me the twist with the Brent Spiner character.
Independence Day Resurgence, obviously the sequel to Independence Day, which has taken 20 years to finally arrive. And some of the actors looked like they were a good 20 years older than they were when they made Independence Day. Yeah, Brent Spiner. I don't know about you, Phil, but I got the impression he was quite categorically dead. I actually rewatched Independence Day last weekend. And yes, it's made pretty clear that he's dead, but apparently he wasn't. He was in a coma.
Okay.
And, he's in a coma.
He woke up in the shower
with his head pointing the wrong way around.
In a coma for 20 years, and now he's woken up. He wakes up with the return of the aliens in Independence Day Resurgence. I have to say, actually, of all the returning characters, regardless of whether, you know, the fact they've kind of just subtly avoided the fact that they killed him in the previous film, well, not so subtly avoided it, he at least of all the returning characters has the most fun. I mean, clearly he's just pleased to be in a big film again, because I don't think his career has been that great since the days of Independence Day and Star Trek. So he's pleased to be in a big budget movie again, and he has an absolute ball with the character. You know, he knows he's in a rubbish film, but he's going to have fun playing the character, and his scenes are probably the most enjoyable of the entire movie. Other characters like Bill Pullman and Jeff Goldblum, they look visibly embarrassed at times at some of the stuff that they're in. Because it is, I mean, I'm not saying that Independence Day was, you know, believable in any way, shape or form, but I felt that it achieved what it set out to do, which was to take an alien invasion and a disaster movie and mix it together with all the characters in it are stereotypes, but they're largely well done stereotypes. The cocky pilot, the kind of the intelligent nerd, the loony scientist. A couple of the characters in that film I thought were a bit insensitive. I thought the comedy Jewish dad, Judd Hirst, was a bit unnecessary, and the camp gay boss was, you know, very insensitive, I always thought. But otherwise, I thought the characters generally were fun. You sort of cared about them. And the setups and the destruction and the fight back were all at least, if not believable, you know, you could buy into it. The suspension of disbelief that was required wasn't excessive. With this one, in typical modern fashion, there's assumption that bigger is better. So, you know, we had a 150-mile wide mothership in the first film. The new one's 2,000 miles wide. I mean, it's the size of the moon, for God's sake. You know, there's absolutely awash with CGI. I mean, whereas the previous film was just as CGI was coming in, but they still predominantly physical effects, and I thought very well done, largely very well done. Even watching it again, an Ultra HD Blu-ray with HDR, I thought the film held up really well. The physical effects actually held well, and the bits that didn't look so great were the bits where they were sort of just starting to use CGI. This film is just washed with CGI, some of which is actually quite good, some of which is not so good. There's lots of stuff where you can see the actors are standing in front of a group, but were standing in front of green screens rather than actually in the locations they're meant to be, and it's just pretty obvious. So some of the effects are good, some of the effects not so good. But yeah, loads of effects, bigger's better. You know, so trashing London, they're not content with just trashing London, they have to lift up half of Dubai and then drop that on London. So you've got like the Burj Khalifa coming crashing down onto the London Eye and this sort of stuff. It's just, yeah, but it's so big that you can't even really take it all in.
Hang on, London was completely destroyed in the first film.
Well, everything was completely destroyed in the first film. I mean, it starts off in a funny way. It starts off quite well because the premise at the beginning is that this is obviously an alternative reality. So the alien invasion was in 96. They've spent the last 20 years rebuilding everything, but also incorporating alien technology into our technology. So they've got this sort of alien and human hybrid technology they're using now. They've got a base on the moon. They've got all these defensive systems they built up because they're preparing in case they ever come back. So that setup actually, I thought, worked really well. I thought, yeah, okay, this is interesting. But then, of course, immediately, once they do come back, it just ascends into more of the same. I mean, in fact, even to the point where certain scenes are almost identical. And a lot of the new characters they brought in, because obviously it's no Will Smith, he wanted too much money to do this, plus a sequel. So they basically just say his character died testing one of the new, you know, alien hybrid fighters. And his son, his adult son, adopted son, is now like hot fighter pilot. There's Liam Hemsworth, Chris Hemsworth's brother. There's another hot fighter pilot. They got the President Whitmore from the first film. His daughter's grown up now and played by a different actress, because apparently the actress who played her when she was a kid, even though she's in her 20s now and could play the part, is not conventionally attractive enough, as they like to put it. So they've got these new characters, some of which have worked, some of which have been annoying. And they kind of just throw it all together. And you just felt like they were, you know, they kind of, because the first film is quite, you know, it's self-contained. You know, the aliens turn up. There are species that go from planet to planet, taking all your resources and going on to the next planet. So they destroy them. Albeit conveniently, thanks to the fact that they're all controlled by one hub and they can use an Apple MacBook to connect to an alien spaceship. But other than that, they could destroy them. So that's it, really. That's the end of it. So, but suddenly we've got more coming back. And obviously the first film wore its influences on its sleeve quite heavily. You know, there's nods to Star Wars and War of the Worlds, obviously, and things like V. But, you know, this time they rip off aliens, something chronic in terms of the main alien queen, if you like. It's just, but it gets to the point where, you know, you're thinking, oh, this is ridiculous. And there's bits thrown in that, you know, weren't in the original film, but sort of like another ship that was there, but we didn't see in the original film, which is kind of feels like cheating. So you've got bigger is better, more effects, a younger cast are getting the youth. The older people look bloody old sometimes, and some of them just like they wish they weren't there. And obviously just taking the paychecks. You've got sucking up to China, something chronic. So we've got lots of Chinese involvement apparently in building the new stuff. They're one of the big world superpowers and they help build all the new stuff. And they've got some Chinese actors in there and a Chinese actress who's popular in China is one of the characters. Basically just trying to get that Chinese dollar in because they want to hit that market. All that kind of stuff. And then it ends completely open-endedly setting up for another film. So it's not even like it's a self-contained movie. It's you feel like, oh, here we go. And yeah, it was disappointing. Ultimately, because whilst the first film was cheesy, it was just the right amount of cheese. This was a massive, huge wheel of the stuff, and it's drowned in its own CGI and nonsense and stupidity, and you end up at the end of it thinking like, God, this was there won't be a third film, I don't think, even though they obviously are planning one. I give it a very generous 6 out of 10 in my opinion. But there you go.
And it just so happens that the aliens turn up again on the 4th of July, 20 years later. Yeah. What a coincidence.
I think they even reuse a couple of lines as well.
It sounds like they've just basically said, oh yeah, we know that happened in the first film, but forget about it, people. It was 20 years ago. People have forgotten.
Well, also, some characters appear...
Wait, for Star Wars.
A rapid kill. Other characters don't appear... Well, like, I mean, one of the major characters in the first film was Jeff Goldblum's wife. She's completely missing in this. What happened to her? No explanation whatsoever. It just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, well, she was one of the main characters, wasn't she? Was the bridge.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah. Okay. Are you still going to the cinema to see it, Ed?
Pass. I don't know. It's dependent on a number of things. My wife is very keen, but she goes for free and I don't. So we'll see how enthusiastic we are tomorrow evening.
It might be your last chance to go to the cinema though.
The electricity's turned off.
Yeah.
I ought to stop looking at replacements for the small hatchback replacements for one of our existing cars and start looking at a war rig from Fury Road.
Yeah, you know. And it was declared our Independence Day, wasn't it? So that it's like, did you not see the movie, mate?
Actually, I'm going to petition for the M1 to be renamed Fury Road now. That could work quite nicely. So the only problem is that post-apocalyptic vehicles, after 30 years of turbo diesels and emissions regulations, the future isn't that apocalyptic, really, is it? You know, we're all just like puttering around with a 1500
spiky Prius.
yeah but if the world was going to a pot in the future, there wouldn't be any big V8s left, would there, or V12s or
Well, I mean, obviously Fury Road's a different one, because Fury Road took the very conscious decision that, as the original Mad Max had happened in 1978, had been filmed in 1978, that no vehicles after that time were featured. That was a conscious decision. There is a school of thought that says, depending on what goes wrong, it will only be big, simple engines that survive. Mm. that and unturbocharged Volkswagen diesels, which are completely indestructible. So cockroaches will quite comfortably survive the apocalypse. Not that I'm suggesting that the events of this morning will lead automatically to an apocalypse. We need to wait until Donald Trump is elected president for that. But, you know.
Yeah, I saw that on Twitter this morning. It's like, yeah, you know, Brexit. Some people might be sad that that's happened, but thank God we're not Americans with the prospect of electing Trump.
I don't know. I think it's fundamentally it's just like in the same way that Brass Eye, ahead of its time, we're just seeing the early events of Idiocracy. Although that means if Terry Crews is going to be president, I'll
Vice President Dwayne Johnson.
You'd vote for him, Steve, wouldn't you?
Yes, I probably would. The Rock would sort out the world's problems. No problem at all. He'd be straight on it. He'd be up at 4 a.m. every day getting
it. It depends which Rock you're on about, because if it's the Rock from, San Andreas, then he's very selfish Rock, him, because he's only interested in his own family and destroying government property.
Or stealing government property, I
think. Stealing and destroying.
Destroying it.
Yeah, you want Fast and Furious Rock.
Yes. He could take Putin in a wrestling match, couldn't he? No problem.
Can you imagine him giving a briefing and inviting the assembled press to get their thunderwear on? And the rock clock will actually become the official worldwide unit for time. We will all be summoned with him shouting at us,
singing actually, if you want.
Well, you would know, obviously you're the expert. I haven't actually downloaded it, so. But yeah, I mean, you know, what's the worst that can happen, eh?
That does segue quite nicely into this week's opening film, though.
Always the professional, Steve, on you go.
Starring The Rock and Kevin Hart, called Central Intelligence, about a...
That's an ironic title, is it not?
Well, isn't it a running joke that military intelligence is an oxymoron, isn't it? But yes, Central Intelligence stars The Rock and Kevin Hart, and in it they play CIA members on a mission, basically, and obviously comedy ensues. Rather should I say, The Rock is the CIA agent, and Kevin Hart is an accountant, I believe. He gets re-meets him via he's an old school friend. They meet up through Facebook, and then he gets dragged into the world of international espionage.
Thank God they went that way and not his brother. Although for comedy value,
yeah. I did. I have seen a clip of it actually on Graham Norton's show when The Rock was on the show, plugging it, and it didn't look very good. So, but and I'm not a massive fan of Kevin Hart. If I
no, no, right. No. But you'll be seeing it because The Rock's in it.
I do like the tagline though, which is
and then you'll and buy it because it's on 4K.
Blu-ray. Yeah, it'll be on 4K. So you have to buy it, even though it's a terrible film.
Yeah. Oof.
Well, that Kevin Hart. Kevin Hart. He was on Top Gear, wasn't he? He was one of the guests on it, and I found him even more irritating than Chris Evans. But she's saying something.
But like I said, I do like the tagline: "A little heart and a big Johnson."
Wow.
Yeah, that was worth everything. So you know how that pitch went? That pitch was somebody went in and said, "This is a tagline," and everybody, "Yeah, that's great. Make the movie." No script. That doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's about as far as the pitch meeting went, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was like that there with Twins. Danny DeVito, Donald Schwarzenegger, and Twins. There you go. There's 50 million. Go and make it.
Yeah, but if you were head of a studio, Steve, you would have greenlit it anyway, because The Rock's in it.
Probably. He's a busy man. I've got to say that. He's doing an awful lot of films.
You know a hell of a lot about him.
I know more about him because people like you, and particularly Ed, keep sending me links related to The Rock more than because I actually go out and search this stuff out. It's like, what was the link yesterday with the guy drinking all the milk?
I thought that was brilliant.
Encapsulated
GIF, and I did say GIF, I don't care. Bloke, drinks 2 gallons of milk, and it sort of cuts back to his wife going, "You can't do this," and it cuts back, and he's turned into The Rock, which I thought was quite amusing.
Yeah, it was quite funny.
So, good news, everyone. Just as an this news is now 3 hours old. You may have already seen it. As of time of speaking, we're no longer the fifth largest economy because we've wiped enough value off our currency in the stock market that France has overtaken us. Hooray. Although, actually, now looking back at that, we do seem to have staged a bit of a recovery on the market. So, yeah.
And by the way, people will be listening on Monday when all of this will have blown over and we're back to normal.
And Gary Lineker has apparently tweeted, "Whatever the result, Nigel Farage will always be a dick." So, yeah.
As far as Brexit go,
so will Gary Lineker.
A time for reconciliation. Then.
I think, as far as exiting Europe goes, we'll be seeing plenty of that next week, won't we? With England.
Yeah. Oh, that's a absolute guaranteed set now, isn't it? Really. Although I've got to say, well done, home nations. You've all done it. You know, you've done everybody proud. Home nation wise, and that's going to be a cracking game. Is it Saturday? Wales
against Northern Ireland.
Yeah,
Wales,
Northern Ireland. Saturday.
Yeah, that's the game to watch. Definitely. That'll be a cracking game. Really will be.
Is it Italy, Spain? Italy, Spain, are they playing each other?
Yeah, Monday.
That'll be a cracking game.
And actually, Portugal, Croatia could be interesting as well because it really depends on which Cristiano Ronaldo decides to attend the match. So, yeah.
Yeah, if you ever wanted to know the term one man team, you just look at Portugal, don't you?
Or Wales.
Yeah, but at least they all fall down to the ego in the Welsh team.
Yeah, Bale hasn't got the kind of ego that Cristiano has, has he?
No.
He just passed it.
But he has kind of carried that team for somewhat.
He has, yeah, but they work as a unit. I think that was pretty evident.
They're actually quite a good side, Wales.
And I mean, you could say the same for Leicester, that Jamie Vardy was the one thing that won them the league. Well, it wasn't. It was the teamwork and it was the camaraderie and it was getting behind each other. So it's taken Wales a lot further than I think they thought they were ever going to get. So, yeah, good. Well done to them.
Conceivably in the semi-finals, quite easily.
Well, I think they'll make the quarters. I think they'll be Northern Ireland. I think should make the quarterfinals, I think, and then it'll be a struggle because we got France. Paris isn't going to be.
You got to say as well, Michael O'Neill's done an outstanding job in Northern Ireland. And I was there when he scored one of the best goals I've ever seen in my life. He scored at Easter Road. Run from his goal all the way up, took a volley on the run outside the box.
Oh, was that him?
That was him, top corner.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to say, I did enjoy watching the Irish beat Italy. That was a hell of a comeback.
Hell of a sing song as well.
Yeah, it was great. It's the first time I've seen Roy Keane smile.
Yeah, but you do know that Brexit now means that we will never ever win a European Eurovision Song Contest ever again.
We were never going to anyway. That really is not too much of an issue, to be honest.
Although Australia were in it this year, so at least we can still take part.
Yeah,
given that Israel and Azerbaijan are also in it, I don't think I think actually we get into that on terms of geography, unless actually of course part of renegotiating Article 50 also means that we'll stop pissing money at the Eurovision Song Contest. I don't know, and that obviously we'd still be allowed to compete, but we wouldn't get automatic qualification. And given that no one ever votes for us, we'd never automatically qualify ever again. So be interesting.
The actual requirement to take part, with the exception of Australia, which is obviously a unique thing, but the actual requirement to take part in the Eurovision Song Contest is you have to be a member of the European Broadcast Union. For some strange reason, Israel is a member of that, hence their presence. Even though you're thinking, but you're not in Europe, but yes. But obviously, I think Australia take part primarily because they have a very large gay community who love Eurovision. Basically, it's really popular there. Didn't they come second? They did quite well, didn't they?
Daily Mash has just published a jubilant Leave voter quote, "We'll catch up with the financial news later."
So for those of us still around and buying stuff in this country, what can we buy on Blu-ray, Steve?
This week on Blu-ray, you've got Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. And the clue is rather much in the title there. You know, it's a version of Pride and Prejudice, but with zombies. That's out on Blu-ray and is also just come out on Ultra HD Blu-ray, at least in the States. I have it. Haven't got around to seeing it yet. But I think Simon's reviewing that disc, so that review should be up this week. 999, which is a thriller that, again, was well-received. I think Kaz reviewed it, said it was okay, but it didn't nearly deliver on the premise and the quality of the cast. But that's out this week and is also How to Be Single, which I'm very much guessing is being released on Blu-ray to time with the fact that women don't necessarily want to watch, not all women, some women do, but not all women want to watch football. And so you quite often see chick flicks getting released around this time as a counter-programming basically against loads of football. So that's out this week as well.
Okay, so that's Blu-rays. Let's move on to Ultra HD Blu-ray Roundup. I've got a funny feeling there's not a lot to talk about this week, Steve.
No, it hasn't actually been much in the way of new announcements. It's been a bit quiet on the Ultra HD Blu-ray front. Obviously, in terms of new releases, just released in the States, that was last week. I think I mentioned it last week, actually, was Star Trek Into Darkness. Yes, in terms of new releases, the only one I've mentioned, really, and it's more a curiosity than anything else, and it arrived yesterday, actually, for me, released in Germany this past week, so... the week that we're recording the podcast, but the week before the podcast goes up. Released in Germany is The Texas Chainsaw Massacre on Ultra HD Blu-ray with Dolby Atmos, Dolby Atmos soundtrack, the DTS 7.1 soundtrack, and also an Aura 3D soundtrack. So that should be very interesting, given it was a low-budget 16mm film shot, probably recorded in mono back in 1974. But
I think if you look at that, Steve, I think genuinely what we can say now at this point is that Aura 3D will not be a major format when it comes to multi-channel on any format, any popular Hollywood movies. I think they've had their chance. We're, 4 years down the line, 3 years down the line? And the only major manufacturer supporting them is Denon & Marantz in terms of a paid upgrade for their AVRs to have it at home. Nobody else is showing any interest in it. So I think safely we can say that Aura 3D's probably had its day in terms of Hollywood blockbuster soundtracks. You'll still get music CDs and all the rest of it because the guy that invented it, Wilfred Van Balen, he's more music-orientated anyway. He owns Galaxy Studios. He's a musician, and that's the whole reason they set that up. Aura 3D was a bit of an invention of his, a sideways invention. He didn't have any background in the film side of things. So I think it would be safe to say that music CDs, DVDs, Blu-rays will have Aura 11.1 sound mixes for the music side of things, I think, in terms of Hollywood. I can't see them doing any better than a handful of titles a year, if any.
Yeah. I mean, to date, there are three. So I think it says it all, really.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a sizable catalogue of films that have Aura 13.1, Aura Barco 13.1 soundtracks that were mixed for the cinema. But that isn't translating to soundtracks on discs, simple as that. And I think it's just too different from the other two dominant formats to really succeed.
I think from a studio as well, you've got to look at your the possibility of playing it back in the home. And if there's only one manufacturer who's not including it as standard, it's a paid-on option. If that's all you've got in terms of a market to be buying discs, it doesn't say a lot for you. And if you're a studio, you're going to ignore it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, it's I bought it as a curio rather than because I absolutely had to have Texas Chainsaw Massacre in Ultra HD and HDR. But I think it'd be interesting just to compare what I've done. Clearly, it's going to be a soundtrack that's been built up from scratch, largely, I would suggest, quite recently, because I don't
think
it was back in 74.
Well, the original was a mono, wasn't it?
Yeah, quite. Yeah, exactly. In terms of the Ultra HD format generally, clearly it's immersive audio is important, and pretty much all the discs that are being announced or released now are coming with some form of immersive audio, but the dominant one is Atmos. So.
Yeah, well, I think that's the way it's going to go, because if you look at DTSX, I mean, they very much were playing the whole, yes, we're coming, we're going to have a technology. I mean, the whole of last year and for the vast majority of this year, they've basically been trying to poo-poo Dolby's success story and saying that they're coming with a rival tech and all the rest of it. We saw it at CES 2014.
January 2015, we saw
CES. CES, the beginning of the year, it always confuses me which year it actually was. But yeah, and it was, oh, well, you know, we're going to announce all this in March. There'll be titles to follow. There'll be like 100 titles by the end of the year and all the rest of it. And of course, that came and went. And we're now 2016. And how many titles exist?
It's about 10 so far that I know of. Although I have to say, Independence Day, the Ultra HD Blu-ray had a DTSX soundtrack, and it was absolutely barnstorming, stonking soundtrack. But yeah, there's about 10 or maybe 15, including some things that have been announced. But it is fairly limited and significantly less than Dolby Atmos. Yeah.
So, I mean, the whole thing with DTS was that they basically won the hand when it came to Blu-ray in terms of standard. I think if you look at Blu-ray soundtracks, the vast majority are master audio compared to Dolby True HD.
Yeah.
I think it's probably about an 80-20 or 85-15 split, really, in terms of titles that have master audio compared to True HD. I mean, this is Dolby's play to at least get some of that marketplace back with Ultra HD Blu-ray, isn't it? And try and get in there as the dominant immersive format. And they seem to be doing a good job of it.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, I think they took it pretty badly, the fact that they effectively lost the war in terms of Blu-ray, in terms of having Dolby True HD as the de facto soundtrack on Blu-ray. It was, as you said, Phil, DTS HD Master Audio, that's probably on about at least 90% of discs. That stung them quite badly, and they were determined not to have the same thing happen to them again with any future format. And part of that process, obviously, was the development of Atmos for the cinema, which they were very aggressive with. And there's over, I think, 200-300 films now with Atmos soundtracks at the cinema. So there's a big catalogue of stuff there already. They pushed it very hard in terms of getting it installed into cinemas. Only this week, there's been announcements about Cineworld building Atmos into their cinemas in the UK. So that's definitely going to be expanding. So that's the big thing. They also got it into the home much quicker than I thought they would. They really did deliver that in the home very effectively and very quickly, and certainly much quicker than DTS thought they would, which is why they've been kind of like for the last year and a half in trying to rain on Dolby's parade a lot of the time without actually having anything to announce themselves. And there's been really good pickup in terms of support from studios. All the studios now have released Dolby Atmos Blu-rays or Ultra HD Blu-rays, with the exception of Disney. And as far as I can see, the way it is panning out now as far as Ultra HD Blu-ray goes is if there is an existing Dolby Atmos mix for the cinema, that's being ported across to the disc.
Yeah.
If there isn't, then the studio has one or two choices. They can either, they could just use a 7.1 DTS HD Master Audio mix, which has been the case on some discs. But the way it's looking now is that they're either going to mix it in Dolby Atmos, which is what Sony are doing on all their discs, or you have the other alternative, which is to use DTSX. And it seems as though where an Atmos mix does not already exist, then people like Fox, for example, are going the route of mixing it in DTSX, as is Paramount and Universal.
Well, you see, the big problem is, Steve, that DTS Cinema no longer exists. Hasn't done for a very long time. It was bought out by Datasat. Listeners to the podcast will be aware of Datasat because they also produce some pretty high-end home cinema kit. But they bought over the DTS Cinema side of things quite a number of years ago now. So DTS haven't been involved in mixing for the cinema for a long time. It's something that they're going to have to get back into if they want to compete, because Dolby, things are still mixed in Dolby Atmos and still theatrically played back. As far as I'm aware, there is no DTS:X theatrical system.
No, they announced they were going to have one, didn't they, when they made their big announcement about DTS:X. It was going to include a theatrical version as well as the domestic one. But I haven't heard of... I think I've heard of a couple of films. I think maybe Mockingbird, Hunger Games The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 2 had a theatrical DTS:X mix. But I'm sure that was purely an experiment. That doesn't seem to have been embraced in the theatre at all.
No. So if you look at it from that point of view, then Dolby has a real head start here, because right from the word go during the production process of that film, there will be a Dolby Atmos mix if it's going to have a theatrical release in that format. There is no way that it's going to have a DTS:X mix at that point. The only point where it's going to have a DTS:X mix is if they then go back to the source material and remix it in DTS:X for the disc release. And that is going to cost a shed load of money.
Well, that's the point. I think if there is a Dolby Atmos mix already created for the cinema, then it's relatively straightforward and cheap to just port that across to the disc, and that's what they'll do. If there isn't one and they want an immersive audio mix for the disc release, then they have the option of either mixing in Atmos or mixing DTS:X. And depending on the studio, it looks as though Sony are going the route of using Atmos exclusively, by the looks of it, whereas Fox and Paramount and Universal are using Atmos if they've already got it, and then remixing in DTS:X if there isn't an immersive audio mix already existing at the theatre.
That seems to be the case at the minute, but there's no guarantee that that will be the case going forward either. You know, it could go anywhere, and I guess it's going to go with whoever supplies the tools the cheapest for facilities to move over to that format.
Yeah,
and again, I would point to Dolby having given away a lot of stuff free.
Yeah,
he's going to be a big designer on that one.
Spend a lot of money laying the groundwork on this.
Yeah. Okay, so we need to wrap up on this. We'll come back to it probably in 6 months' time and see where we are when it comes to massive audio. That will have given UHD Blu-ray a chance to kick on as well, and hopefully we won't be skint by that point as well. We got to wrap up, but before we do, Star Wars news, Rogue One characters have been announced. I think the big one there is, Darth Vader's back.
Darth Vader is most definitely in the film. Interestingly, it has not been announced who is physically playing. Obviously, James Earl Jones is doing the voice, which is excellent news, but they haven't announced who's physically playing Darth Vader.
Oh, who cares?
So it might be just a stunt man or a large bloke. But who knows? Maybe it's Hayden Christensen.
As long as it's not Kevin Hart.
With a Rock.
Rock would be a great Vader. but yeah, so they've basically given the names of all the different characters in the film and an idea of who's doing what. And so Donnie Yoon's character is a blind, not Jedi, but apparently he's a follower of the Force. Alan Tudyk is playing voicing at least a CG character, a robot called K2S0, I think it is. So I still am looking forward to this. I think I've got a lot of hope for this film. I think it'd be fun. Even though there was all talk last week about, reshoots and all this sort of stuff, I still think it's going to be great fun when it comes out. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, so that's Rogue One news. We're all looking forward to it, especially with Vader back. And that about wraps it up for this week's podcast. The word here, they did speak at some point, Mark Hodgkinson.
Get him off the ship.
He was also here, and he also did some speaking, although it was some time ago, Ed Selly.
I'd rather not take sides.
And the guy that did all the talking this week and wouldn't let anybody else have a word in edgeways, Steve Withers.
You're going to start to lose vision in your left eye.
Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You can bookmark AV Forums for latest reviews, news and video. And of course, leave us those 5-star ratings. Did we forget, Steve?
We did forget.
It's all the EU's fault. So
okay, we'll blame it on them then for this week. We'll read them out next week. So get your 5-star reviews in on iTunes, and we'll read your name out, and we'll read your if you leave us something witty, you'd more likely to have it read out. So there you go, there's a challenge. Write something witty. I'm Phil Hinton, thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you again next week.